5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Can't you hear me?
Jones, and we're very proud to have you talking to the Rocky Review because you are from Canada.
Yep.
And I guess the first question I'm going to ask is, what inspires you to create the kind of rock and roll that you do?
I don't know. You just want to play rock. I mean, you want to do rock and roll, so you just write a bunch of tunes that sound good to you. And, you know, you write enough to make an album, and then you go on tour, and you have a lot of fun touring, and then you want to do it all over again, so you have to write more songs. So,
I mean, was rock and roll just kind of bred into you from a young age?
Yeah. I've been listening to rock all my life, so it's not something I got into recently.
Yeah, it's been with you a long time.
Yeah.
So what would you say is the perfect recipe for a great rock song?
Well, obviously, any song is, you know, you need a catchy chorus, but I don't really give it much thought, and I think that's the key, is just blank slate, and then just follow your intuition, and whatever sounds good to your ears. If it sounds good to you, chances are it'll sound good to, like, all other people. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, enough people that will keep you writing more songs. And so that's all I've ever gone on, and I think that's all we ever follow too.
Okay.
As a band.
Now, the title of your current release, Rock and Roll is Black and Blue, was actually one that you held on to for quite some time.
Yeah.
Tell listeners what it means and where it came from.
Well, I mean, Rock and Roll is Black and Blue, like you said, was an old title we had for something we wanted to be put something out. Our first thing we ever put out, we wanted to call it Rock and Roll is Black and Blue, but there was another band from the scene that put out a 7-inch called Real Rock and Roll Tonight, the Deadly Snakes, and so we thought the usage of the rock and roll term was too redundant within such a small scene at the time, so we just shelved it. We had a song called Rock and Roll is Black and Blue, too, but when we couldn't come up with an album title for this one, JC suggested it to Adam. And he liked it, so we already liked it because, you know, JC liked it, and he knew I liked it. So, yeah, it made it an easy decision.
Okay. So you're a believer in the raw cachet of music, performance being your most direct correlation with the fans. Does it make sense for bands to make full albums anymore?
I think so. I mean, in terms of putting on a full show, you want to have a full album to play.
What about bands just starting out, though?
Even more so, because you don't have anything. If you put out 3 songs, those are the only 3 songs you can play. So your set is only 12 minutes long or 15 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Is that where you think the industry is going?
Well, with some bands, it is. Like, you're seeing a lot of EP releases, and then they will just...
Well, EPs are what you put out when you're first, when you start out as a band. A lot mm-hmm. of the times, bands will put out a few EPs and then put out a full length.
And they will just build on those EPs. So some guys have said, you know, it's pretty difficult for bands to make a full album, full production album anymore.
Well, it is because, you know, it's expensive. It always has been.
Yes.
Record labels aren't around as much as they used to be, and the money isn't getting thrown around like it used to be, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But with the advent of digital recording, it's made it cheaper on the other side of it. It's made it cheaper for bands to record. Whether it's a good enough recording to listen to or not is for someone else to decide. But I kind of think that it should be full length albums. If not, then we're just going to revert back to how it was, like, I guess before the Beatles or something, when people would just put out 7-inch singles, you know.
Mm-hmm. And that's what some people have said. So I was curious, you have a lot of years in the industry, what your take would be on that?
Well, I don't really like that kind of way of doing things, and luckily enough, the bands that I like will probably never do that, so it's not really my problem. And I'm sure we're just going to keep putting out albums, because that's the only way we know how to do things. So.
Okay, good. So Just a Beautiful Day recently hit number 26 on the Active Rock chart, and you must be pretty happy about that. You've always said that it didn't really matter whether the band had a lot of radio success. It was mostly about recording the kinds of songs that you absolutely enjoyed. Do you think it's possible for bands to maintain highly successful careers without the aid of radio or television?
Yeah, I mean, you can list like 100 bands that don't get played on the radio that have been around for 10 years or more. You know, they're obviously not successful enough to fill arenas, but they're successful enough to keep putting out albums, and they have a fan base that supports what they do. Mm-hmm. They're just not as known as, you know, some of the top end bands, you know, but those are the bands that I listen to anyways, so I mean, I support them, and if I do, there's thousands of other people who do as well.
Right.
It's just that they don't number in the millions, that's all.
And a lot of times it's luck, you know, there's some luck that's involved, because if you have a big band that likes what you're doing, oftentimes, you know, they might end up taking you out on the road.
Sure, I mean, that happens all the time, but I think even for the big bands, for every big band, there's a band that's not as big that could have taken their place easily. There's always exceptions, of course, but for the most part, all the bands that you see, you know, that are quote unquote big, they could easily be replaced by an equally competent band. Mm-hmm. That's around right now. So.
So describe what you like to do in your downtime. When you're not trapped within this lifestyle.
Right. It's pretty much a continuation of what happens on tour. Obviously, you know, I'm at home, and I really spend my time working on the columns that I have, and the podcasts that I do, and the songs that we write, and that's about it. I've managed to cut out a lot of time wasters over the few years. I don't play video games anymore. I used to a lot. I don't watch as much movies and TV shows as I used to. I wish I did. I wish I could. Sometimes on the road you can. But I find more joy out of, like, coming up with a column, you know, writing it and sending it to my editor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's just me, though. It takes a lot of time to do that on a weekly, monthly basis. And as time moves on, you know, you run out of things to talk about and write about. So it does kind of get harder over time.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay, well, let's talk about what Duff McKagan recently wrote about Danko Jones.
Mm-hmm.
In the Seattle News Weekly. And he said, "The band plays as such a seething and tight three-piece unit that, in the throes of a gig, the beauty of not just watching or focusing on one guy is only realized after the show. It is rad." What does it mean to you to hear those kinds of words coming from a musician that you probably idolized?
Well, I mean, it's definitely flattering. I mean, Duff, we spent a lot of time with Duff last month in Australia. And over the years, we've run into each other. It was nice to read those words that he wrote. It was flattering, like I said, complimentary. It made kind of justified all the stuff we've done, and in a way, and to get validation from, you know, someone who you listened to and followed and looked at and, you know, kind of admired, is definitely very satisfying.
And humbling.
Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So, like you said, you're a podcaster, and you come from the early days of college radio.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you also have your weekly blog on Huffington Post. I've heard you say that you don't really pay attention or give much concern to reviews anymore, and you made a statement that really struck a chord with me. I want to talk a bit about it. You said, you can't really do justice to a record when you've only listened to it once or twice.
And you mean in terms of reviewing it?
That's right, and it's so true. So being a successful writer, podcaster, what would be the one tip you would provide to aspiring music journalists out there? Because they're all over the place right now.
Yeah, they are. Well, a lot of the time, especially a couple of days ago, I did an interview with somebody who was familiar with our band name, and that's about all that they knew about us, which is fine. And I don't care if you like our band or not, but have to interview us. It's your job, you're doing a job, and I respect that. But you should really kind of do the work and do some research into whoever your subject is.
Absolutely.
Whether you like them or not. And then I find that lacking in a lot of quote-unquote rock journalists.
I would agree.
And also on a bigger picture is the lack of musical knowledge. If you are going to write about music, and if you are going to, you know, work within the music industry on any level in any capacity, I think you should have more than a basic knowledge of music. Mm-hmm. Like, it should be a little more advanced than the average. And thus your place inside it. And I find that most people don't.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
All right. Out of all the seasoned power trios, which one has had the biggest influence on this band?
Power trios? Probably ZZ Top, my favorite of them. Obviously Rush, being from Canada, that's an obvious. But really, I think it's like ZZ Top.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of bands that are four pieces that have the same three-piece instrumentation. Everyone from Sabbath to Zeppelin to Black Flag. They all have the same instrumentation we have. One guitar, one bass, one drum, one singer.
Who did you grow up trying to emulate as a guitarist?
As a guitarist? Billy Gibbons was a big... I like his playing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But as a guitar, I never really thought about guitarists. Eddie Van Halen, I mean, obviously, you know.
Who wasn't inspired by him, right?
Eddie Van Halen, Billy Gibbons, James Hetfield, you know. The rhythm is really a big part of this band. It's more rhythm than any kind of guitar display.
Definitely.
So it's more of songs than actual soloing for me. Even though I listen to all those guys, all those guitarists, like, you know, Tony McAlpine and Greg Howe and Marty Friedman and all those kinds of, like, those Mike Varney guitar players on his label. But it never really inspired me to be like them.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What about as a vocalist?
Oh, well, that's a little more personable, because it is... the person, actually, and there's a lot of singers that I like. David Lee Roth and Ozzy Osbourne, and I like Gene Simmons personally. I like Ian Gillan. I like Gene Simmons' vocals, but I wouldn't consider him one of the best vocalists. Phil Lynott from Thin Lizzy. But yeah, those would be some favorite singers.
Okay. So what would be the greatest challenge about being a three-piece lineup? You got a lot of stage to cover.
Yeah, that's...
And you're only a three-piece.
I mean, in terms of performance, sometimes, being a three-piece, the stage overwhelms you. Bigger stages overwhelm you. So we kind of try and make up for that through, you know, volume and some of the banter in between the songs. And when we toured with Guns N' Roses for a year in 2010... We really had to learn that fast because their stage was just so big. And in order to, you know, be main support for Guns N' Roses that had, like, I think, seven guys on stage covering that space, you had to really utilize that space. And we learned to do that over the course of the year. So now when we get on bigger stages, we're not as overwhelmed, I think.
So. And you guys were never, you know, heavily into production. It was very much about your sound and delivering that.
Well, it was almost an anti-production where, you know, it would be like one amp, not a battery of Marshall stacks. You know, it was more like one tiny amp or whatever, what have you. And out of that, you know, small setup would come this big sound. That was the whole point. But, you know, that was when we started, and that was 17 years ago. We started off as a garage band, which is what you do when you're a garage band. But we're not a garage band anymore.
No,
we play arenas like we are tonight, and we play festivals, and we play big clubs. So we can't really keep that aesthetic and make it and keep it real. Like, we would be faking it, I think. So, you know, as the popularity of our band grew, you know, we had to make some adjustments, and you know, we did away with a lot of those, you know, the small timey aspects of a garage band. We got into better studios, and we worked with producers, and we worked on our songwriting, and you know, all that kind of, I hate to use the word progression, because in music I think that's a bad word, especially with like rock and roll, but we just changed. You know, like humans do.
An evolution, you have to be.
Yeah, like, yeah, I mean, you can't, if you stay the same, I think it's almost, you know, I think you're almost a bigger poser, deliberately trying to stay the same and fighting what you feel is where you're supposed to be. We felt like we should, you know, try and write some songs that had bridges, you know, and try and get better at our instruments. So that was natural for us. So I think that was real, as opposed to like deliberately trying to play stupid when our capabilities and our chops were advancing naturally. So.
Okay. So you've had the CD, you've had the DVD, you've had the book. What's up next for Danko Jones?
Well, I mean, you know, there's still like this album that we still have to tour on. We just put it out 6 months ago. So, you know, there's quite an extensive tour that goes along with every album, and it usually lasts for about a year and a half, and we're half a year in. So we still have a good year before things start winding down.
You got lots of festival gigs.
Yeah, we have like, when we finish this tour, we have a 2.5-week tour of Europe, headlining in Europe, and then we do the summer festivals in Europe, and then there's other things planned but can't be announced yet.
Right.
But that bleeds into the fall, and who knows what happens after that, but definitely more touring.
Excellent.
There's projects that we talk about at this stage, but there's nothing set in stone and moving.
It's hard to plan when you're out on the road. It's very hard to plan.
No, not really. I mean, we've hatched ideas on the road before, but and usually it has nothing to do with us implementing it. But you know, at that stage, it's not discussed yet because we still have to tour this album.
That's right.
There's still a lot of work to do for this record, you know.
Okay. All right, one last quick question. I have to ask you this. You're a self-proclaimed leg man. You even wrote a song about it.
Uh-huh.
Who
Two songs, George.
Well, Legs is the one I'm
right.
referring to.
But there's another song on Never Too Loud called Still in High School, and I do say that I'm a leg and ass man. So there's two
okay.
songs.
So who has the most picture-perfect legs of all time?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of them, but a pair of legs that really caught my eye was Sid Charisse. She's an old dancer from, I believe, the 50s and 60s. And I mean, if you see a Fred Astaire movie, you will see her. She's pretty drop-dead. She's got pair of drop-dead legs.
Well, there you go. Straight from the mouth of Danko Jones. Thank you so much. great interviews, reviews, and music news, visit rockyoureview.com.